Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrn, a potpourri podcast by me, veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed.
Does the idea of normalizing problem animal behaviors strike you as an oxymoron? Did it cause you to mutter, if the behavior was normal, it wouldn't be a problem, would it? Whether any behavior is normal, though, depends on how it affects companion animals, their owners, or others who interact with those animals. Knowledge plays a key role in this process. If we know what constitutes normal species behavior, plus the norm for a cat or dog with our animal's breeding and history, our range of normal behavior will be much larger than that of those lacking this knowledge. But what about in our daily interactions with our animals who periodically exceed our limits? For starters, perceiving normal animal behaviors as problems can lead you down a long and frustrating path. For example, Heloise prefers to pick her dogs based on their looks. Given that she finds sniffing dogs disgusting, she spends a lot of time telling her new, adorable Basset Hound not to sniff. But expecting dogs not to sniff because we find it disgusting is like telling dedicated landscape photographers to ignore their surroundings when traveling through a scenic environment with fantastic views. In both cases, not displaying the perceived problem behavior is a problem for them. In addition to the innate predispositions, our animals come pre-programmed with some basic priorities just like we do. Successful humans and animals are born explorers. We all want to know our territories and where we fit in. This is why it's difficult to convince an untrained dog to come just because we said come. Unless we devoted the sometimes considerable time and energy necessary to teach the dog to cede those territorial responsibilities to us, it's normal for many dogs to take off to investigate anything that gains their interest. Maddening and even terrifying for us, perhaps, but not abnormal for our dogs in those circumstances. Whatever the source, the concept serves to remind us that our animals may do things that are perfectly normal for them that may drive us mad. Our beagles may sniff more, our greyhounds may be more easily distracted by the slightest motion, our bored house cats may stalk anything that moves and grab it with teeth and claws. Scenthound history goes back to at least 1100 AD. Sighthounds even further to 7000 to 6000 BCE. And the feline predatory response was being honed and reinforced millions of years before that first human-feline interaction occurred. Because the predispositions for these behaviors are deeply embedded in these animals' most ancient genomes, trying to change these is akin to changing the proverbial leopard spots. In these situations, it makes more sense to accept these behaviors as normal and seek more acceptable ways for our animals to experience them. However, in other situations, normalizing problems we can change also has value. In my experience, this takes two forms. One is normalizing as a successful strategy when treating animals with serious medical or behavioral problems. I'd like to claim credit for this human orientation to animal problem behavior, but I can't. I owe it to my clients, as well as others I informally interviewed or who shared information about their experiences with such animals. What became an ongoing learning process formally began when I was doing some research for a behavior and bond-based veterinary client communications text. At the time, I never expected that it would change the way I perceived the physical and behavioral healing process. I had experience in veterinary medical and behavioral bond practice by then and wondered what, if any, owner orientations most help those people and their animals when the animals succumb to serious medical or behavioral problems. Was it their devotion to their animals? Did the caregiver's age, sex, education, income, or marital or partnership status play a role? Did it matter if there were children or other animals in the household? I learned that all of those factors could influence if and how people chose to treat their animals with serious problems. But what eased the human-animal burden and thus increased the animal's chances of success was the caregiver's ability to perceive the animal's problem and its treatment as normal for them and their animals at that time. This enabled those people to hang in there day after day, doing whatever needed to be done for as long as it took. On the human side of the bond, these people didn't see themselves as saints or martyrs for choosing to treat their animals' problems. They gave no more of an emotional charge to applying eye drops 3 times a day, medicating smelly dog or cat ears, giving multiple pills daily, than they did the daily services they provided for their own and their children's well-being. Similarly, visions of themselves as saints or martyrs didn't fuel their willingness to confine their aggressive dogs to their property and keep the animals under their control at all times. They considered this a perfectly normal response. In other words, they were willing and able to normalize their animals' problem conditions and their treatments of it. You may be thinking, yes, but that was then and this is now. Then, meaning the pre-social media society of the early 90s when I was interviewing these people. And I agree. Social media likes and often richly rewards saints and martyrs, villains and victims. Any extreme. Normal doesn't gain a lot of attention. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on individual preference, there may be a big credibility gap between social media perception and reality. Aside from that, social media notoriously has a short attention span. Thus, companion animal caregivers, depending on daily support for their saintly or self-sacrificing approach, may soon find their cause displaced by another. And in today's world, that is likely to happen faster than ever. It's far more energy efficient in the long run to see the animal's problems and treatment as normal. That in and of itself would be beneficial. But normalizing the treatment of problem animal behaviors also confers another advantage in the healing process. A stable, neutral, normalizing, and supportive human emotional response. Although expressing the emotions we equate with our saintly or martyr roles may make us feel better, These may have destabilizing effects on some animals. Those effects may be heightened in animals who feel vulnerable for some reason, as most animals with serious behavioral problems do, in my experience. These animals need a reliable caregiver reference point, a calm and confident human role model who communicates, "What you and I are doing may be different, but right now, it's normal for us." Putting this in context of animals' ability to catch human emotions via emotional contagion, I can't think of a better message to communicate when facing the resolution of serious animal behavioral problems.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Catova Arts, www.catova.com.